Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
This country's mass incarceration of the poor, you know, is like a giant plank in this country's eye that has to be removed before it can see clearly.
Welcome to Radio Ambulante Unscripted, a new way to listen to Latin America, part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm Daniel Alarcón. Today we're talking with novelist Sergio de la Pava. A lot of books are described as sprawling or ambitious, and Sergio's breakout novel, A Naked Singularity, is certainly both of those, but it's so much more than that. I read it this year, though it was originally published in 2008 and re-released in 2012 by University of Chicago Press, and I'm just going to say like this, I was blown away by this book, just by its audacity, by its inventiveness, by its relentlessness. I mean, it's part heist novel, part dystopian comedy of manners, part indictment of our criminal justice system. And if that sounds heavy, it isn't at all. It's really funny and very readable. And on this last point, you know, novelists, and I know about this because I am one, we don't always like to do our research. In this case, Sergio did, and he did it for years because his day job is as a public defender in New York City. Sergio's protagonist, Cassie, is a public defender too, and he finds himself quite unexpectedly involved in the perfect crime. So when Sergio de la Pava writes these incredible courtroom scenes, or when he breaks down the criminal justice system the way that he does, he knows what he's talking about. I found this book so startling, I just wanted to chat with the author. And Sergio began by telling me that he's equally obsessed with writing and with his job as a public defender. Here's what he had to say about these two very different worlds.
Well, you know, they're vastly different things. I mean, I get some kind of feedback on my legal work almost on a daily basis. And I think you know, I mean, when you write a novel, you basically shut yourself down for, in my case, you know, several years. And it's kind of an isolating existence, I think most writers would agree. And there isn't that, you know, day-to-day feedback or reward, let's call it, that drives you forward other than, well, today was a great day, I wrote 300 words or something like that. That's how, you know, pitiful my output is. I'm not usually happy with 300 words.
That sounds great to me.
With my other job, you know, it's usually like a human being. Not usually. There always is a human being who's the focus of the events, and that human being is not me. It's someone else who's been caught up in this machine, this mass incarceration machine, and I'm just trying to maybe plug holes where I can or in some way be of use. So it's a lot more immediate. It's a lot more urgent. It feels a lot more intense. But at the same time, I, for whatever reason, find myself bringing that kind of intensity and urgency to this other world that we're discussing. Although I recognize that, you know, one is essentially a form of play and the other one is rather serious.
I don't know. It seems to me that they're both kind of serious in that one of the central accomplishments of the novel is this critique of the criminal justice system as a systematized brutalization of the poor. Did you know that you wanted to write this critique?
Here's the thing. If I set out to give a critique, right, in essence, I've decided the issue for myself. I've have the answer, and now I'm trying to clue you in. I'm trying to convince you that my answer is correct. What I was hopefully trying to do more with this in the parts that relate to the criminal justice system is be 100% accurate and remove a lot of the superficial fictionalization that most people are given when they watch something like Law and Order or, you know, anything like that. And as you say, this country's mass incarceration of the poor, you know, is like a giant plank in this country's eye that has to be removed before it can see clearly. So my goal was not to convince you of anything so much as to say, by the way, that stuff you see on Law and Order where, you know, the cops are heroes and they're just doing the best they can and everything's slated against them and the poor DAs, here's much a more accurate picture of what it looks like in New York, you know, where we, deal with 100,000 arrests in each borough a year. And this is a more accurate picture of what it looks like and draw your own conclusions.
Yeah. When you went into it as a young PD, did you know that was the world you were getting into? Did you know that the odds were stacked in that way? Or did you have an inkling and then the actual reality of it shocked even you?
Yeah, I think that's really a good way and a perceptive way of putting it, which is you have this inkling, okay, I'm in law school and I say, well, you know, really the only job that interests me is being, you know, representing poor people who are accused of crimes. I only like criminal law. And I had an inkling that, you know, I felt this was the correct thing to be doing. But yeah, I mean, you're naive. You're in law school. You haven't actually seen what the situation is the way I can now clearly see it. So you're right. It was an inkling that turned into, wow, I'm glad I picked this side, let's say.
And has it ever been too hard emotionally? I mean, it seems like a Cassie is young, you know, Cassie, the protagonist of Naked Singularity, is determined to be a PD who always wins, you know, and then he has this colleague who wants to do the perfect case. And there's all this kind of almost a heroic sense that, yes, we can do it. It can be done. But then I just sort of wonder about the despair. It must be there, right?
It can be there. It has been there in the past. It's also kind of intellectually interesting work. It can also be funny, I think, comes across in the book. It can be funny work. A lot of people charged with crimes. They're really interesting people for some reason, I find. So there's a lot of genuine mirth and intellectual curiosity about the work as well. But yeah, I mean, there's the downsides, of course. Now, you know, with Cassie and his, let's call it, or let's say Dane's pursuit of perfection and Cassie's acquiescence to it, I would argue that it's less about concepts like justice and fairness and more about their ego, which I have a healthy one myself, if I'm being honest with myself, right? I mean, when I'm on trial, I mean, it's an intellectual contest. It's me against another attorney, and I want to win. And part of that reason I want to win is because I think I want something good to happen for my client, or I want to avoid something bad for my client. So it's kind of like a contest. And Cassie doesn't want to lose contests.
Right.
So I thought that was an interesting, I hope, an interesting split that was maybe portrayed, where if you look past a bit of the puffery, you come to realize that, you know, Cassie's sense of his own worth is maybe a little problematic, let's say.
Yes, yes, I get that. I forgave him that, and I forgive him a lot of things because he's so funny, you know?
Right.
You know, and I guess that humor goes a long way in a novel that tackles very serious issues. Is there something that a novel can do that a TV and film, even documentaries can't do?
Yeah, I mean, film, let's just all put it under the rubric of film. It's basically images, right? I mean, it's a wildly superficial form. At least with a novel, you know reality is being manipulated and it's designed to work in certain ways that nonfiction doesn't work. And I think there's a depth to novels. I know there's a depth to novels that isn't there even in the best television or movie. The novel is just a brilliant truth delivery system along with the 10 other things it is. I think, for example, you know, not to, I guess, spoiler alert is what people say, but, you know, there's depictions of the death penalty in this book that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think that might be a productive way of looking at it, that I think, you know, we've all read nonfiction books on the death penalty. We've all read nonfiction articles on the death penalty. And I guess I'm biased because I'm a novelist, but I tend to think that there's a role for the novel there that maybe even exceeds that kind of exploration of it.
Yeah, maybe just a kind of basic acceptance of complexity. This part is built into the form, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe you're more likely to agree with me than the average person. But when I hear, like, or when I read, you know, so-called, you know, cultural critics say, well, you got to see Mad Men and you got to see, you know, Lost. These are the new novels. These are replacing novels. I say, you know, replace away for whoever the consumer might be. But if you think that they're analogous in terms of depth, in terms of understanding, in terms of creating empathy, in terms of everything that the novel does, you're way off base. And I would argue that if you're going that crazy about Mad Men, then you may be time to break out the Tolstoy or the Virginia Woolf and see what real art looks like.
I want to talk a little bit more about the reality, because you know, you've had a lot of success with the Naked Singularity, and you're able to draw from your experience and give a critique and give a realistic assessment of what's going on. Tell us, what is it about your work? What has your work taught you about the criminal justice system, and how exactly are the odds stacked?
When we're talking about this country and we say something like the criminal justice system, you know, if you're referring to the rules that are in place, things like, you know, the presumption of innocence or the burden of proof, things like that, the right to remain silent, the Fifth Amendment right, the Fourth Amendment. If you're talking about the rules that are in place, they're actually quite, you notice a pretty striking feature, which is they're actually quite beautiful and they're actually quite fair. The problem is, you know, how they're being applied. And I would argue that how they're being applied in a particular instance isn't a really great issue. What's the real problem with criminal justice in this country is the mass volume of arrests, the overwhelming number of arrests. And, you know, concurrent with that, the vast number of people incarcerated, which exceeds, you know, other countries by a lot. So I'm not, you know, creating this utopia and saying, why aren't we doing this? I'm just saying, like, hey, why do we have to arrest people at seven times the rate of, say, Germany? Mm-hmm. I mean, is there something about the Germans that is, you know, conducive to not arresting people at the rate we do? Maybe. If it is, we might want to look into it and see if we could maybe copy them. I think any right-thinking human being would say, what has changed since, you know, say, 1970? What has changed in the last 40 years that has, you know, seen an increase in the population of incarcerated individuals go from 300,000 people to 2.3 million people? We're in a criminal justice disaster. We need to stop incarcerating so many people. That would be a nice first step.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about a little bit about the story of your career as a writer, because it's so surprising and even inspiring. You know, I don't know if you see it that way, but am I right? I read that A Naked Singularity was rejected 88 times.
Yeah, I mean, I gave that number when somebody asked me. You know, I think people naive about publishing say to you, how many publishers rejected it? Not even realizing that there's this whole other step before you even get to a publisher. Mm-hmm. So where you essentially send out these letters and say to agent, right? So you're trying to get an agent. I essentially contacted, I guess, around 88 agents saying, hey, here's this book. What do you say? It's a really dispiriting process that in my case went on for years. And even though my wife was essentially good enough to handle that for me, because I find that kind of thing highly distasteful, it was not a fun time, let's say.
But you didn't quit. I mean, that's the part that seems like something out of a superhero
Well, I did quit sending it to agents. Let's put it that way. I said enough of that, and I didn't send it to publishers. And it's, you know, we're talking about 2007, and my wife says, well, there's this thing, you can just publish it yourself. You pay these people and they'll create the book. This is, I think, before e-readers even, so it's like an actual book.
It's like print on demand, right?
Yeah, exactly. Print on demand, you know. And so I was like, go ahead, whatever. We printed the book, and, you know, I think from then on, you know, you sell copies to your family and stuff like that. Luckily, I have a big family, so I probably sold about 100. But and then I forgot about it. I just kept, you know, got to work, got to do some more writing, and my wife kind of took it upon herself to function the way maybe a publicity director might, sending it out, trying to get people to review it. And that's what ultimately did the trick. I think enough people reviewed it favorably that I guess these divisions are weird, but if we'll call it the mainstream, eventually became aware of it, and University of Chicago and things of that nature.
Right. So this book went on to be, it was translated into Spanish. It just came out recently, actually. And I was in Colombia and actually saw people talking about it. And being that you're Colombian, or nominally Colombian, as you say, was there any special thrill to seeing the book translated into Spanish? Were there family members who were able to read your work for the first time, or?
There's others forthcoming, but the Spanish translation was the one I was certainly personally invested in. I have a lot of very close family members who, you know, maybe gave it a shot in English, but said, I'll wait for the Spanish. So, yeah, I was definitely invested. I'm still invested in it. And I think José Luis Amores did a great job.
I guess you've probably been asked this before, but, like Casi, you know, you were once a young public defender, and like Casi, you were, you know, born to Colombian parents. So I was wondering how autobiographical this book was.
It's kind of a weird thing about, you know, writing in the first person, right? I mean, so you have this character who has these similarities, external similarities that you just pointed out, and now you're writing from their viewpoint. It's kind of hard not to have your viewpoint dominate. But that was the challenge, where I will... I felt most free when Cassie would say something or act in a way that I absolutely would never do, would never act, would never say these things. That's where I felt the deviations kind of is what give you the thrill, right? Otherwise, you might as well be writing a memoir. So there are similarities, but at the same time, I like to think or hope that I'm a bit wiser about these kind of issues that, and maybe I wasn't at 24, which is his age, right. But I certainly am now, many years later.
Your author's note on the back, it's very simple. It says, Sergio de la Pava does not live in Brooklyn. And for the new book, for Persona, it says, still does not live in Brooklyn. And I was wondering, is this to sort of set yourself apart from Cassie to say, you know, hey, I'm not my protagonist? Or is it kind of a way of saying I don't belong to the literary epicenter, which, you know, is basically Brooklyn-based right now?
From a purely factual standpoint, what happened was the publicity director from University of Chicago called me and said, well, we have to do the About the Author section. And I think he knew that that was not going to be one of my favorite sections. I wasn't going to really want to divulge a lot of biographical details and things of that nature. So he said to me, you know, if you want, I can just put, you know, you're a writer who lives in Brooklyn. And I didn't live in Brooklyn, so I thought that was a little funny. And I said, it's a funny assumption, and we all know, you know, the kind of subtext of that. And I said, but why don't you instead write, you know, he's a writer who does not live in Brooklyn. And he, to my, you know, surprise, they said, yeah, let's do that. And I was like, okay. And obviously, you know, this is a way of, as we pointed out, the tortured history of this book. And, you know, I'm not the nicest guy in the world, and quite a bit of animosity probably built up in those years. And this might have been a way for me to signal some kind of outsider status. But, you know, years pass and that kind of stuff fades away. And when the next book came out, I said, well, just write that I'm still don't live in Brooklyn. I don't know. I found it amusing.
It happens that publishing a novel in the U.S. while having a Latin surname often comes with a bunch of silliness. You know, it comes with a certain sort of identity questions and identity politics. And you managed to avoid that almost completely. I think from what I've read about the book, it's not like anyone's talking about the book in terms of it being a Latin novel or a Latino novel or anything like that. I guess my question is, how did you pull that off? Or is that just a happy accident?
Well, I think you've identified something that's A, not good.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is, like, as you said, mainstream publishing's desire to pigeonhole people.
Right.
Right? So it's not a novel written by an Indian novelist, it's an Indian novel, which to me never really made the greatest deal of sense. And you're right, I'm not really in a great position to complain about this because it generally has not been done in my case. But every time I've seen it, I get offended. It's a way of marginalizing someone to say, well, if you're interested, if you find, you know, Hispanic culture exotic and want to know more about it, then this is a good novel to pick up, which I don't think any real serious novelist would make that the goal of their work. So already you're telling me you're implicitly refusing to engage with the literary merits or lack of merits of the work, and you're saying this is an example, let's say, of trading on of an exotic background, which is just obviously insulting. I think to any serious writer would be insulted by that. So it's really time for that to go away and for the work to be evaluated on its own, whether, and if it's bad, it's bad, and if it's good, it's good, and if you responded to it, great, and if you didn't, but it's at no point is there going to be, you know, this notion that somehow the book is to be evaluated differently or somehow marginalized because of the ethnic background of the writer.
Sergio de la Pava is a writer and public defender in New York City. His most recent novel is called Personae. If you like this episode, make sure you check out our other interviews with Latino and Latin American authors, journalists, artists, and thinkers. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher. Just search for Radio Ambulante Unscripted. And while you're there, please subscribe and leave a review. We really appreciate it. This interview was produced by Silvia Viñas. Special thanks to production intern Diana Buendia and to John Kalish. Radio Ambulante's team includes Martina Castro, Camila Segura, Luis Treyes, Claire Mullen, Constanza Gallardo, and David Pastor. Carolina Guerrero is our executive director. Radio Ambulante Unscripted is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Radio Ambulante tells the stories of Latin America. I'm Daniel Alarcón. Thanks for listening.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.